bigger, an Epstein-Barr viral load. If the latest information you're hearing or reading out there says otherwise, the source should be considered a throwback to the Dark Ages, or even the time of the dinosaurs and a relic of outmoded thinking. Until medical communities wake up to the fact that EBV is the real culprit behind thyroid issues, and not just a sidekick to other factors mistakenly regarded as the instigators of people's poor health, thyroid testing will remain limited in its helpfulness. Even as new, groundbreaking thyroid tests come to the table, which they will, there won't be enough. Research can come up with the best, most state-of-the-art methods for testing the performance of the thyroid gland, and they will completely miss the point. What doctors and labs really need are more advanced tests for EBV, tests that track where the virus is in a person's body, its path of travel through that individual's system, its levels in various organs and glands, and how it feeds and mutates. So the premise of testing thyroid hormone production itself already falls short. These tests misdirect healthcare professionals and patients, making everyone focus on one effect of the virus, impairment of the thyroid, rather than the much bigger picture that it's a virus causing that damage and wreaking havoc elsewhere in the body at the same time. For this reason, I won't go into great depth here on the specific tests. Thyroid hormone tests. That said, tests, such as those for T4, T3 and thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH, are what we have right now. And they are pieces of the puzzle. If you and your doctor interpret them with the mindset that they're indicators of a virus affecting the thyroid gland, rather than the thyroid becoming weak and letting you down, then they can put you on the right track. If your tests come back indicating abnormalities in thyroid performance. As I said, many enlightened doctors and patients have begun to notice that these tests can come back in the normal range, even when every other sign points to something amiss. Here's why. The accuracy of these blood tests is, unfortunately, inconsistent. That's why I call them guess tests. To begin with, thyroid hormone readings can vary widely, depending on the time of day and the patient's stress levels. It's much like the white coat syndrome many people experience when they walk into a doctor's office and get their blood pressure taken. Just sitting there under observation can get your palms sweaty and raise your blood pressure above normal levels, throwing off the accuracy of the readings. In the same way, sitting in a lab or exam room about to have your blood drawn can get your adrenals pumping, which completely changes your blood chemistry, because suddenly, adrenaline, also known as epinephrine, and cortisol, also known as hydrocortisone, both steroids, flood the bloodstream in preparation for fight or flight, disrupting homeostasis in the process. These high adrenaline and cortisol levels can make it look on a blood test like you're producing more than enough of the thyroid-related steroids T4, T3, and TSH, whether you truly are or not. Or adrenaline and cortisol may be saturating your brain and putting your pituitary gland, which produces TSH, into overdrive, again throwing off blood test results from what they'd look like normally. Even if the sight of a needle doesn't bother you at all, a disruption of homeostasis could still be affecting your blood chemistry. If you're someone who experiences chronic stress, then you may live with constant elevated adrenaline and cortisol, or as we looked at earlier, these levels may be high from compensating for your underactive thyroid, or you may have adrenal fatigue. With adrenal fatigue, the adrenal glands can produce adrenaline and cortisol erratically, sometimes flooding the bloodstream and sometimes holding back. In this case, Your adrenals may be overactive when you're getting your blood drawn, even if the doctor's office is your favorite place in the world. And so, again, the results can be inaccurate. I've seen people get a thyroid blood test 1 week, go back to get blood taken a week later for another purpose, and have the thyroid profiles on each come back with completely different numbers. Assessing the results of just one thyroid test is too limiting. It means that doctors can unknowingly miss if a patient has a thyroid condition. With blood pressure, many doctors and nurse practitioners have learned that the best way to deal with inaccurate measurements is to take a few blood pressure readings over the course of an appointment and average them. A similar approach would help with thyroid testing, although what it would really take is a thyroid test once a day for 30 days and then an average at the end of the month. This would be more helpful, though it still wouldn't solve everything, because the tests themselves are antiquated. A few decades from now, hopefully medical communities will finally catch on to the true viral cause of thyroid disease, and the testing will be better. Until then, healthcare professionals and patients deal with thyroid tests that are too broad in range and not attuned to the subtle hormonal shifts that can signal a thyroid condition. The hormone guess tests are so unstable that it would almost be more accurate to make a fist for 10 seconds, release it, and see if it took more than 3 seconds for color to come back to your palm as an indication of a thyroid problem. Millions of women unknowingly walk around with hypothyroids that wouldn't register on today's tests. Sometimes it takes months or years of living with an underactive thyroid for it to progress to the point that a lab can detect it. In the meantime, a person must live with worsening health due to the virus's progression and no answers. While we can pretend everything is fine, that won't get anyone better. None of which is to say that you should write off thyroid tests. You simply need the background above so you can interpret the results with perspective. If you're going in for thyroid testing, ask to be tested for TSH, free T4, free T3, and thyroid antibodies. Reverse T3 testing is currently a fad that's not worth dwelling on. While it does reflect genuine problems, it can pick up on so many at once that it's hard to know what any result means. It's fine to have your doctor order the test, it just may not help you pinpoint to a reliable degree. Thyroid antibodies tests. Thyroid antibodies tests deserve some extra attention here, because out of the thyroid tests, these are the closest to picking up on viral activity. Again, though, it's all about perspective. Currently, medical communities consider the antibodies detected in these tests to be autoantibodies, also called antithyroid antibodies and antimicrosomal antibodies. That is, antibodies your immune system creates to go after your own thyroid tissue. The antibodies are taken as evidence that your body is attacking your thyroid, and you end up with an autoimmune diagnosis. In reality, this is not what's happening. That interpretation is based completely on assumption. When scientists first discovered the antibody activity and couldn't figure out why it was happening, it was a convenient theory to say that the body must be malfunctioning. Trouble is, neither conventional nor alternative medical communities have yet moved on from that theory. It remains undeveloped science. Remember, your body does not attack itself. The antibodies that show up in tests, such as the thyroid peroxidase, TPO test, are, in fact, your saving grace. They are not going after your thyroid. They do not cause damage to the gland on any level. These antibodies are created by your immune system to target the true troublemaker, EBV. Part of what confuses medical communities is that medical research and science have not yet discovered the thyroid's personalized immune system that we looked at in Chapter 5, your symptoms and conditions explained. The special lymphocytes we talked about, which are not yet catalogued, are assigned to the thyroid area, like soldiers that guard the thyroid. Though they're temporarily led away from the thyroid during the transition from stage 2 to stage 3, the thyroid, a highly intelligent gland, sends out an emergency signal for the specialized lymphocytes to return once the thyroid realizes it's under attack. Once back, the lymphocytes work symbiotically with the antibodies your immune system produces, allowing these antibodies into the thyroid so that the antibodies can attack the EBV there and get it out of your body. The confusion here is that medical communities see the antibody activity and think it means that's the source of the problem. This is not accurate. Your special lymphocytes and these antibodies are working together to defend you. So when looking at the results of any thyroid antibodies tests, remind yourself that if antibodies show up, they're due to viral activity in your thyroid, not a mistaken response by your body. And if antibodies don't show up, this doesn't mean EBV isn't present in the thyroid. Like the others, it's a test that's still in progress. Unlike with thyroid hormone tests, it's not blood chemistry that can throw off antibodies tests. Rather, the antibodies tests' weakness is that they are not yet broad enough or sensitive enough to detect smaller amounts of antibodies. When EBV is in an early phase in the thyroid, your immune system hasn't yet made use of all of its bells and whistles, so the antibody activity may not be enough to register on lab work. Plus, there are so many varieties of EBV, with mutations continuing to develop, and this diversity means there is also diversity in the possible antibody reactions and antibody creations they induce, with certain antibodies geared toward these mutations that are not on blood labs' radar. Current tests only pick up some of those reactions and creations. Translation. You may well have antibodies in your system that test results don't show. These are antibody varieties that are literally off the chart because they are uncharted territory. They haven't been discovered, so blood labs don't look for them. If a blood lab doesn't know an antibody exists, it's not going to be commissioned to search for it. It takes funding and authorization to look outside the box of what's known, although you don't need a lesson from me on red tape and regulations. I'm sure one way or another, you're plenty familiar with these. Your own thyroid expert. Given that these scientific methods of diagnosis are still in development, when it comes to determining if you have a thyroid illness, you are your own best expert. If your test results don't give you any insights, know that if you are experiencing any of the late-stage symptoms we looked at in Chapter 5, they can be major indications that your thyroid has already been targeted by EBV and continues to be affected even as the EBV advances through your system. Above all, remember that your thyroid is only one part of what's going on with your health. Though all of the medical focus on thyroid testing can make it seem like the opposite, and past test results may have made you feel like you were either making up your problem or like your thyroid was in terrible shape and you were somehow to blame, don't let it get you down. Today's thyroid guess tests are not, ultimately, about getting to the root of your health problem and offering you answers. They're about determining whether someone should go on thyroid medication, a topic we'll cover in the next chapter. Chapter 8. Thyroid Medication. For centuries, there was a popular concept that if a part of your body was ailing, you treated it by consuming that same body part of an animal. If, for example, your leg were diseased, You might eat a leg of lamb in an attempt to bring it back to health. If your brain or kidney were in trouble, you'd eat brain or kidney, respectively. If an eye issue were troubling you, you'd be advised to consume the eyeball of an animal in some way, shape or form. And this wasn't limited to folk remedy, by the way. It was prevailing medical wisdom that doctors learned in the most prestigious medical universities during their training. The problem with this mode of treatment was that it never worked. Your leg, brain, kidney, eye, or other body part would continue to act up unless you found another mode of healing. Not that this was acknowledged. The theory seemed to make so much sense on the surface that it continued to hold credibility straight through from the Middle Ages for hundreds of years. And believe it or not, it holds credibility in today's nutritional supplement world, where there's still belief that if you ingest a capsule that has brain or liver bile material in it, it will somehow help your own brain or liver. By the time goiters started to become a widespread problem in the population at the time of the Industrial Revolution, it was still a theory that doctors carried in their bag of tricks. So one doctor decided to see if offering dried and ground pig thyroid to a goiter patient would bring down the thyroid swelling. For the first time in the history of treating body parts with body parts, it worked. In the 1800s, dehydrated thyroid became a commonplace goiter remedy that you could pick up at the drugstore. No one knew why it brought goiters down, though they were happy to go along with it. Was it a miracle cure? No. Consuming thyroid worked for these early thyroid patients only because goiters of the time were caused by serious iodine deficiencies, due to industrialized food processing that stripped food of its nutrients, coupled with toxic overload from a polluted environment, and pig thyroid offered them a rich source of iodine to balance their health. As time went on, widespread iodine deficiency opened the way for the first wave of early crude Epstein-Barr virus to target the thyroid, though the virus was still so mild that it only took a little dose of iodine, an antiseptic, to kill off the problematic EBV, and the desiccated porcine thyroid provided just that. Over time, EBV mutated and grew stronger, and people developed bigger problems than iodine deficiency goiters and not-so-aggressive, low-grade viral goiters. They developed the EBV symptoms we looked at two chapters ago that are mistaken for thyroid symptoms. Still, desiccated thyroid seemed to make a difference in many of these patients. Why? Not because the medication was offering them T4 or T3. It had nothing to do with thyroid hormone replacement. Rather, it was because with desiccated thyroid, the medical establishment had also unknowingly stumbled upon its first steroid compound. The concentrated hormones in the animal thyroid acted as an immunosuppressive anti-inflammatory drug on some patients, meaning that thyroid swelling would go down, other viral symptoms would abate, and it would seem like a person was getting better. In reality, the concoction was causing a shut-off of their immune system response to the EBV. The truth about thyroid hormones. Today's thyroid medications are not at all far off from those thyroid drugs of yore. Some of these medications are, in fact, still made of desiccated porcine thyroid. Others are synthetic. Either way, current thyroid medications act as steroids, just as those early ones did, though many doctors don't realize this, and no one knows that the steroid effect is why some people may notice a little more energy, mental clarity, and improved sleep when they begin taking thyroid medication. It is partial relief from their low-grade viral infections, and that's all. Another common reason that some people feel relief or experience weight loss on thyroid medication has nothing to do with the medication itself. As I've said, the overwhelming majority of people who see these improvements are ones who at the same time they went on a prescription, also changed their diet, went on supplements, and or got more exercise. It's this removal of EBV's favorite foods, coupled with immune-boosting nutrients and lifestyle improvements, that changes these people's health for the better. Taking thyroid medication for years contributes to a sluggish liver, and because the medication is a steroid compound to underactive adrenals, these factors usually translate to eventual weight gain around the belly and other spots in the body. Medical communities are under the mistaken impression that these improvements are due to thyroid hormone replacement, though again, in truth, it has nothing to do with filling in for hormones that a person's body is having trouble producing or converting. Whether animal or synthetic, the hormones in these medications are not bioidentical to human thyroid hormones, which means they're missing key chemical compounds, which have not yet been discovered, that set human thyroid hormones apart. Plus, the thyroxine in thyroid medication essentially fakes out the pituitary gland, sending it the message that the thyroid is producing enough of its hormones to suit the body. Think of the difference between synthetic thyroxine, desiccated animal thyroxine, and human thyroxine as the difference between feeding a baby factory formula, cow's milk, or breast milk. Enough research has come to light by now that we know that even as close as outside sources may come, breast milk can't be matched. The day will come when research reveals the same about human thyroid hormones. The only source that can fill in for these hormones comes from within the body. It's the special blend that the adrenals produce in compensation for an underactive thyroid. When someone has a bad reaction to thyroid medication, which thousands do, it's because her body is so fine-tuned to this difference that it can't tolerate hormones that come from a non-human source. What we need to keep in mind is that whether a person feels better, worse, or the same on thyroid medication, it is not prescribed for the thyroid itself. It does not heal the thyroid. Many patients are not aware of this. They think that because they went to the doctor and received a prescription to treat their thyroid symptoms, the prescription is treating the problem itself. Meanwhile, the EBV can continue to damage the thyroid and cause other worsening symptoms, and the thyroid disease can continue to progress. If you take medication for a hypothyroid, you'll still have a hypothyroid, and you'll still have EBV. Unless you take the express measures we'll hear about in part 3, thyroid resurrection, to get rid of the virus and care for your thyroid. This explains why you can still be gaining weight, losing hair, feeling fatigued, and generally suffering even after you've gone on medication for thyroid issues. It's a common experience for millions of people. They're diligently taking their medication every day, and even though that medication is causing thyroid test results to indicate normal hormone levels, their thyroids are getting worse over the years because no one knew to look for the underlying issue and address the real cause. I've seen people who've had their thyroids removed and who weren't taking any thyroid medication feeling great after they've got rid of their EBV. I've also seen people who were on thyroid medication with or without their thyroid, and who hadn't gotten rid of their EBV yet, who felt terrible. If feeling better were all about thyroid hormones, neither of these scenarios would exist. The people missing their thyroids would need thyroid medication to function, and everyone who was on thyroid medication would be restored to health. The reality is that it's all about the thyroid virus, Epstein-Barr. When EBV is present and active, it's going to be a drain on someone's health, regardless of whether she or he is on thyroid medication. Also, remember those adrenal replica hormones we looked at in Chapter 4, your thyroid's true purpose? Because your adrenal glands produce adrenaline blends that replicate thyroid hormones when the thyroid gland is underactive, essentially, your body creates your own medicine. Though close enough to your true thyroid hormones that your body uses them in the same way, they are subtly different enough that blood tests won't pick up these blends as thyroid hormones. As a result, doctors will prescribe thyroid medication not knowing that your endocrine system is producing a dose of its own prescription to fill in for the thyroid's tasks. Where the body really needs help is in immune system support to lower the viral load. While you're taking the steps in this book to free yourself of EBV, if you'd also like to truly support your thyroid hormones, you can make your own thyroid tonic by following the instructions in Chapter 25, Thyroid Healing Techniques. Thyroid medication and TSH readings. It's important to understand the true relationship between TSH readings and thyroid medication because it's one that's frequently misunderstood. Here's a common scenario. Your blood test results show a TSH reading of 10.0, which your doctor sees as the start of a hypothyroid issue and so proceeds to offer you medication. After starting on the prescription, you go back for another blood test, and this time your reading is in the 4.0 to 5.0 range. It's easy to think this means your thyroid is being treated. In fact, all that's happening is that the thyroid hormones in your system from the medication are faking out your pituitary gland, telling it that you're making enough hormones so that your pituitary will produce less of its thyroid-stimulating hormone. That lower TSH reading gives a false sense of security. Your thyroid itself is not getting any relief from the medication. The way your body is truly functioning, that TSH level should still be at 10.0. The medication is merely masking it. And over time, since the EBV isn't being addressed and it's still highly active inside your thyroid, possibly due to triggers in your life, your thyroid's performance will continue to worsen. That means you'll go back to the doctor after a while on medication, and those TSH levels will have climbed back up again. It's very likely that the doctor will put you on higher and higher doses of medication. If you're someone who isn't experiencing many thyroid virus triggers in your life, your thyroid medication dosages may remain steady for a longer period before increasing. Years down the road, your TSH reading may reach 10.0 again, which means that without the medication obscuring the results, you would really be at a 20.0. The hypothyroidism is not being treated by the medication. It only seems like it is. This effect of thyroid medication on TSH readings is sort of like slapping a band-aid over the poke hole from a sword's deep, dirty cut. The wound will continue to fester if it's not cared for properly. If someone doesn't say, "Hey, what's this sword wound doing here in the first place?" Or think of medication's effect on TSH readings like taking the battery out of a smoke detector. While it may put you at ease because the beeping stops, all you've done is disable the alarm system, not put out the fire. Thyroid atrophy. It's good to be aware of one side effect of long-term thyroid medication use that's completely unknown to medical research and science. In some people, thyroid medication can train the thyroid to lessen its hormone production so that the gland slowly atrophies and shrinks over time. Essentially, the medication dumbs down the thyroid. Just like your muscles need to be used to stay strong. So too does your thyroid need to do its job regularly to stay in shape. You know how when a snowstorm keeps you cooped up indoors, you may feel frustrated at first. If the storm lasts for a while, though, then day by day you get a little more used to the forced laziness. Staying inside in your pajamas feels more and more comfortable and natural, so that by the time the storm passes, the prospect of digging out and re-entering the world seems like too much energy. That's what can happen over time to the thyroid with long-term thyroid medication use. The thyroid loses some of that yearning to produce hormones. Its soul is almost hampered because the medication is telling the pituitary gland that enough T4 and T3 are being produced. So the thyroid doesn't get the TSH signals that keep it in gear. Not that you should worry. This type of partial thyroid atrophy only happens to some people who have been over-medicated with prescription thyroid hormones for a number of years. It doesn't happen to everyone on thyroid medication. And even as thyroid medication makes less work for the thyroid will defy this and produce some thyroid hormone no matter what. Plus, the thyroid's radio-like frequencies that monitor and promote homeostasis will continue to function in the face of atrophy. Remember the undiscovered thyroid hormones R5 and R6 that play a role in these frequencies are virtually impossible to deplete. Still, it's one of those possible side effects you should know about. As you've heard over and over in this book, your thyroid is resilient. So you should also know that when you start taking the steps to tame EBV and revive your thyroid, it brings the thyroid's intelligence back to life. Your thyroid's highly equipped database is able to override the state of atrophy, and your thyroid returns to functioning the way it's supposed to function. What to know about weaning off thyroid medication? If lowering or going off thyroid medication is a decision you've made with your doctor, there are some key points you need to know. First, when someone consumes a medication such as a thyroid prescription, the liver automatically absorbs and processes it, because the liver is the body's protector from all outside substances. The higher the dosages you've taken and the longer the time period you've been on them, the more medication your liver has absorbed and is still holding on to. This is not something that's measured at the doctor's office. Medical research and science are still ignoring this fact. If you took the liver of someone who had been on thyroid medication for many years, wrung it out, dehydrated all that medicine you squeezed out, and put it into capsules, you could fill hundreds of bottles of thyroid medication. If you've just gone on thyroid medication, your blood tests may not register any difference in your hormone levels at first because your liver is absorbing most of it so quickly. As a result, your doctor may end up prescribing higher dosages over time, which will likely continue to be soaked up by the liver. At a certain point, it's different for everyone, it could take 10 years, the thyroid medication buildup in the liver can become toxic and burdensome to the organ, and the liver will slowly begin to release the medication back into the bloodstream, sometimes in intermittent spurts, because it's overloaded. When this happens, it will throw off blood tests, making it look to your doctor like you're producing more thyroid hormones than you are, another reason why they are only guess tests, and doctors find themselves continually adjusting the protocols for many patients. Many times, doctors will see your thyroid panels coming back with better levels, and they'll think it's because your thyroid is performing better, when in reality, it's because the liver has reached its fill-up mark and begun releasing medication back into the bloodstream. The medication being released back into your bloodstream is not as active or viable as when you first took it, though, It only has about 5% band-aid effect for the body. And because it backs up into the bloodstream like this, rather than being ingested, breaking down in the stomach and assimilating through digestion, your body can have an adverse reaction and you may become intolerant to your medication. This can often result in feeling allergic in some way, where you feel swelling or a racing heart or have difficulty sleeping when you've never had that problem before. When one of these reactions happens, it's common to need to switch from synthetic to compounded natural or vice versa, or even to be forced off of thyroid medication altogether because your body has become so sensitive to it. Even without this overflow effect, thyroid medication taken for an extended period, some people have been on it for over 20 years, can put additional pressure on a liver already made sluggish and stagnant by EBV, which can lead to more weight gain, among other symptoms, over time. If you've been on thyroid medication for a long time, you may want to talk to your doctor about keeping your dosages lower so your liver can do some detox. Take great care with it and don't make the decision on your own. Sometimes people decide they want to go cold turkey and stop their thyroid medications all at once. The effect can be overwhelming, with symptoms such as fatigue returning immediately. People often conclude that they need the medication, so they go back on it, feeling that they'll be dependent for life. Here's what's really going on with those symptoms. First, there's the withdrawal to consider. When someone has been taking a steroid for years, the body goes into shock when those drugs go away abruptly, and the result can be a lot of physical discomfort. Doctors know to wean patients off of other steroids very slowly for this reason, and they should treat thyroid medications no differently. Secondly, when you stop taking thyroid medication all at once, the liver gets an immediate sense of liberation and releases old thyroid medication it's absorbed over time back into the bloodstream, often very quickly. With all those hormones suddenly in the bloodstream, the body can react adversely, causing the symptoms people mistake as dependence on thyroid medication that are really detox symptoms. For someone who's only been on thyroid medication for 3 months to a year, the detox may not be that formidable. You may only experience a day or week of feeling a little tired, depending on the dosage you were on. Once you've been taking thyroid medication for over a year, weaning off slowly is especially important so you don't overload your system. This liver detox is ultimately helpful as it helps unclog it and prevent you from gaining more weight. When evaluating how long the weaning process should take for patients, doctors should always consider how long someone has been on thyroid medication. It makes a real impact on someone's health and well-being as they lower her or his dosages. If someone has only been on thyroid medication for 2 to 5 years, the dosage should be cut by a quarter at a time, stretched out for at least 2 months. If someone has been on thyroid medication for 5 to 10 years, that weaning process should extend to at least 4 months. If someone has been on thyroid medication for 10 to 20 years, weaning should take at least 6 months. And if someone has been on thyroid medication for over 20 years, then the weaning process should take at least a year. It's very important to know that no matter how long patients have been on thyroid medication, their sensitivity needs to be factored in. Someone could already be dealing with neurological fatigue or another neurological symptom or condition caused by EBV, which could amplify that person's reaction when coming down off the medication. If you're the patient looking to lower your dosages, consult with your doctor about what's best for you. Meanwhile, your thyroid is still producing its own thyroid hormones to some degree, plus your adrenals are producing those hormones that don't register on tests as backup. To give them support, your goal should be to become proactive about knocking EBV out of your system and bringing your thyroid back to health with the tools in this book so the gland can rebalance and produce the hormone levels it's meant to produce. This will support you as the medication leaves your system so that you have the best chance of feeling great. Levels of revelation. Some advanced medical professionals have caught on to the limits of thyroid testing. They've noticed patients who present with classic hypothyroidism symptoms and whose thyroid panels come back in the normal range. These doctors put the patients on thyroid medication anyway, and sometimes the patients will start to feel better. Finally, being taken seriously and heard like this is progress for thyroid patients. It's far better than the days when a woman would visit the doctor with chronic mystery symptoms and hear that nothing was wrong. "You just need to exercise more," was the advice they'd get. Or, "Find a hobby. You just have too much time on your hands." That's the type of non-diagnosis that can make someone lose all trust in her powers of perception. The new approach is also more enlightened than when a woman visits the doctor with aches and pains, heart palpitations, weight gain, hair loss, memory loss, and confusion, and hears it's all about hormone imbalance and that she's going through menopause or perimenopause. This type of diagnosis makes countless women feel old before their time and as though suffering is a natural part of aging. It isn't. When the thyroid factors into a doctor's evaluation of a patient's chronic health issues, it is progress. When that doctor recognizes that the thyroid may be involved even if tests don't pick up problems, or that a prescription from a compounding pharmacy is better than synthetic, is all the more enlightened. And still, these revelations are not there yet. They're advancements for the history books. The truths you've just examined about how EBV is the real cause of thyroid issues and much more, about what your symptoms really mean, about how thyroid testing works, and about how thyroid medication completely misses and bypasses the underlying cause of your illness, are for your life right now. The revelation that your thyroid is a messenger, not the problem, is the expert-level knowledge you need to ensure a brighter future. As you move forward with your health, it may be easy to get distracted. New theories will surface, old theories will get revived and recirculated, and you may wonder if the thyroid information you hear about on TV or read about in the latest literature is what you should be listening to instead. Remember this. As long as a thyroid theory puts the blame on you, your body, or triggers alone, it is not correct. As long as a treatment is not going after the underlying virus, it will not solve anything. To arm you against so much competing and confusing misinformation out there, we'll turn now to the great mistakes of chronic illness. By discovering these key blunders that hold back medical advancements, you'll gain new clarity, trust, and freedom, so you can finally heal. Part 2. The Great Mistakes in Your Way. Chapter 9. A Bridge to Better Health. How do you get from where you are to where you want to be? How do we transport ourselves from this place where we're standing to that place over there, beyond the obstacle? As long as humans have been on the planet, we've been asking these questions and answering them by building bridges. It likely started when our ancestors stumbled upon one of nature's bridges, perhaps a fallen tree spanning two riverbanks, and from there, the idea developed. A gap didn't have to be the end of the path. We could create our own support structures to carry ourselves and each other to new land. Through the millennia, Builders and engineers have developed techniques and technologies to advance bridge building to its place today as one of the highest sciences. We now live in a world where the wonder of these inventions has become commonplace. We walk, bike, or drive over them without necessarily giving them too much consideration. And yet, if you stop to think about it, each bridge represents tremendous care. Think about all the math, physics, design, planning, and then actual construction that go into every one. It takes extraordinary skill to understand and harness the laws of nature and, in the end, create a bridge that's safe and sound for the hundreds, thousands, or millions who will cross it. What defines bridge building is that it has to be right. In the final product, there's no room for error, because people's lives are at stake. If someone has a high-minded idea for a new bridge design or a hunch for an improvement on accepted practices, it needs to be tested. Prototypes need to be created, and then more advanced models. Every line must be exact, every angle precise, every calculation quadruple-checked, every material tried and true. All of the elements must be accounted for, and the foundation must be exactly right for that exact terrain. When it comes to treating chronic illnesses in today's medical communities, to bridging patients' divide between feeling unwell and reaching that promised land of vibrant health, there are no similar calculations to make. Doctors can't measure, weigh, or size up chronic illness. They can't throw specifications into an advanced software system like engineers do and get a visual of what someone's healing path should look like. The funding that will lead medical research and science to the most correct and advanced diagnostics and prescriptions simply isn't there yet. Instead, doctors are left to feel it out. Partly, they rely on those areas of medicine that do get funding and try to apply whatever they can from those tangentially related studies. Mostly when it comes to chronic illnesses, such as thyroid disease, doctors must rely on theories. Theories that I've mentioned in earlier chapters of this book, such as autoimmunity, genetic blame, and metabolism. It probably sounds a little strange to hear them called theories, because in contemporary medicine, they're treated like fact. And yet, once you investigate them a little more, you come to realize just how many unknowns are supporting them. These are the types of theories that, in bridge building, would have to undergo rigorous testing before they were put into practice. In that testing, they would start to crumble. Fissures would form. The weak points would reveal themselves. The experts would realize that, for example, the theory of Hashimoto's thyroiditis as the immune system attacking the thyroid couldn't be offered to people as an answer to explain their suffering, because it wouldn't truly support them. Hearing that your body attacks itself doesn't transport a person to better health, because it's not the truth. The experts would learn too that trying to cover over the cracks with pieces of tape, like pointing to inflammation as cause, couldn't keep those cracks from deepening or the bridge from falling apart. That's the interesting thing about chronic illness. In this field, the term expert is unique. In so many other disciplines, even in other areas of medicine, such as surgery, an expert is someone who understands an issue's underlying cause. An expert surgeon knows how to use a scalpel just right, and to stitch up the heart to repair a leaky valve. A legal expert understands the loophole in a law that allowed a criminal to get away with murder. An expert engineer knows when a bridge falls down how to acknowledge it, document it, study it, figure out the underlying problem, maybe the wrong grade steel was used, and then address that issue in all future designs. And yet, someone heralded as an expert in thyroid disease or another chronic illness doesn't need to get to the bottom of why those symptoms happen in the first place in order to receive that title of expert. It's one of the only areas in the trade and professional worlds where it's so grey. As well-meaning as these people are, they're operating off of recycled ideas about what seems to cause improvements in some patients, and going by old theories that have been grandfathered in as acceptable medical advice. That's why it is time for you to become the true thyroid expert in your life. You've already gotten so far by examining the thyroid virus and how it works, the true purpose of your thyroid, the secrets behind what causes the symptoms attributed to thyroid issues and related illnesses, and the truth behind thyroid testing and medication. Now we're going to look at some of the greatest mistakes when it comes to chronic illness. Knowing how to avoid these is one of the most vital elements of building a sound, solid bridge to better health. Grave mistakes. Mistakes happen. We all make them. Sometimes we don't even know we're making them. We're just operating on incorrect information from others and taking their word for it. It's no one's fault, and yet a mistake like this doesn't leave us in any less of a mess. Say, for example, you drive to the grocery store. Your son's friend is staying with you while his family goes through a tough time, and all he'll eat in his state of distress are cornflakes. This is your one window of time to stock up during a busy day, and when you get to the cereal aisle and look at the shelf, the space for cornflakes is empty. You flag down a clerk. "Excuse me, do you have more of these in the back?" you ask.
"I'll check the storeroom," he says, and hurries away.
When he returns, he's empty-handed.
"Sorry, we're all out. You'll have to wait until we get our next delivery."
This doesn't sit right. A supermarket out of cornflakes? You ask to speak with the manager. When the clerk brings her to you, you explain your situation. "Are you sure you don't have a single box in the store?"
"John's already checked the storeroom,"
the manager says, then catches your eye.
"Let's check one more time," she adds.
Together, the manager and the clerk disappear. A long while passes as you wait for them to return. Finally, they approach, each holding an armful of cornflake boxes.
"I'm so sorry," the clerk says. "I can't believe I told you that we were out. They were on an unmarked pallet on the opposite side of the room from where they're supposed to be."
"Yes, we apologize," the manager says. "We don't know how this happened, though we won't try to make excuses. I'll walk with you to the registers and tell your checker to give you a discount to make up for our error."
So some people make some honest mistakes. You had to spend a little extra time at the grocery store. And maybe no one was really at fault. Maybe the person who usually unpacks deliveries was out sick, and her substitute didn't know the job well enough. In the end, it's no big deal. You caught the mistake and didn't leave empty-handed. Besides, it was just a box of cereal. No one's life was at stake. The mistakes we make in daily life, even the really bad ones that ripple out to affect others, are still just normal mistakes. They're part of the human experience. Much as they may hurt in the moment, we can try to learn something from them and move on with new wisdom. A great mistake, on the other hand, is no box of cornflakes. It's a mistake that you didn't make, though you have to pay for it in a big way. A great mistake is a grave mistake. It's not any one person's fault, though that doesn't make it any less dangerous. And it's one that's not acknowledged as being a mistake at all. Have you ever had a joke played on you? It might have felt uncomfortable, annoying, or even disheartening. In the end, you found out it was a joke.
You figured out the family member or co-worker or friend who had propped the bucket of water at the top of the door so that when you walked through, the bucket tipped and you got drenched. Maybe it even seemed funny once you understood. Or maybe you didn't ever figure out who did it, which was okay, since at least you knew it had been a practical joke and it was over. What if you were tricked or fooled and you didn't know it was happening? What if, for your whole life, there'd been a running joke that no one ever told you about? What if the same joke had been played on your parents and they never knew either? What if it had been played on your grandparents too, and your great-grandparents, and great-great-grandparents, and great-great-great-grandparents? That wouldn't be a funny joke at all, though at least it had been put to rest for those ancestors who had passed. What if the joke were still being played, though, on your children and on your children's children? That wouldn't be a joke anymore. It would be unthinkable. It would be a great mistake. We're taught in today's society that we always have a choice in life. No matter what we hear, we have the power to choose our direction. Well, a joke that you'll never let in on takes away that freedom of choice. A running gag that silently held you back in life and that's now holding back your children takes away your right to find something better because you don't even know these limits are in place. Back before the women's suffrage movement in the US, when women weren't allowed to vote, it was acknowledged in many circles that it was wrong. What allowed it to change eventually was that it wasn't a secret rule. It was out in the open that law prohibited women from voting. Women and their supporters knew that this wasn't how it should be, and so they had the choice to take a stand and fight for the right for women to cast their own ballots. Because the great mistakes are hidden in plain sight, you don't get that same choice. You don't know what opportunities you're missing out on unless you discover the truth. The great mistakes of chronic illness. Chronic illness has reached such an epidemic level that I call it an epic-demic. And with the great mistakes of chronic illness, the stakes are just as high as they were for women's suffrage. Millions of people are living limited lives, held back from experiencing a basic human right. In this case, the right to good health, though it's been in secret. We aren't being told that these are great mistakes holding back millions of people, so nobody knows to stand up against them. They are so ingrained that they seem like the facts of life. We trust them, just as we trust that if a road leads to a bridge, it's safe to drive over. If there are no orange cones or detour signs, we believe that the authorities have everything in order and we should follow where others have gone before us. And yet, the truth is that the medical theories, trends, and misconceptions that make up the great mistakes are, indeed, mistakes. Some of them have been holding us back for generations and will continue to hold back future generations unless they're stopped. Many of them started as genuine efforts to help people or to impress colleagues with high-level reasoning, and then, like jokes gone bad or runaway trains, they gained momentum. Now everyone has gotten on these trend trains, and they're going so fast that their sheer speed seems like confirmation that they're on the right track. No one realizes that the train's conductors and engineers long ago lost control and that the trains are now barreling along on their own. Some of these mistakes, like the belief that you created your illness, are new enough that the emergency brake can still be used and we can bring the train to a stop. Others, like the autoimmune theory, are going at such a dangerous velocity that the only way to save yourself is to jump from the escape hatch to the getaway car before that train derails. When you discover the truth about the great mistakes, you get the safety mechanisms you need to protect yourself and the ones you love, and you get back the freedom that you didn't even know you lost. The 9 great mistakes of chronic illness, which we'll delve into one by one as we move through part 2, are autoimmune confusion, mystery illness,